Let me not parameterize it by this. They parameterize it by tau. So I think the expression we ended up with was something like this. Okay, and we interpreted that Berry phase as a measure of the solid angle enclosed by the surface. So your path integral again is sort of the locus of points that omega, the unit vector, takes as it traverses around this sphere in time or imaginary time. And that path has to be closed, remember? So let's see, something like that's your unit vector. It's moving as a function of imaginary time as you sort of go through the, you know, extra dimension of the path integral from 0 to beta. Okay, so if I call this solid angle omega, then the topological part of the action, which I'm calling the Berry phase as topo, is IS omega. And last time we finished the class by arguing for the quantization of S because of the ambiguity of defining omega on this two sphere. Right? Let me just run through that quickly, just to review. And then I'm going to show how this is related to a vector potential. So the basic argument is that when the action is exponentiated, that's the object that controls the physics of the path integral. So it should be somehow invariant. You can imagine setting the Hamiltonian to zero. Just for sake of argument. Then we have to reconcile this fact with the idea that I could have defined my coordinate system such that instead of defining omega with the orange solid angle, I could define an omega prime with the purple. So one for a coordinate system defined with z like this, one for a coordinate system defined with z and minus z flipped, right? So then the part of the action that matters, oh, I did want to write it like this. This is how I wrote it last time. So I just parameterized, since that path is closed, and there's no velocity in the Berry phase, right? You can just write it as a closed path, a closed integral like that. Or if you reverse the definitions of this axis, so So it'll be, let's see, cos pi minus theta. Which gives you minus is omega prime. Okay, so the equation we ended up with last time is something like that. Right, which is just a statement of this condition that, you know, the physics isn't changed by the definition of this coordinate system. But then that leaves us with e to the I s omega plus omega prime has to equal unity. And because we're on a sphere, we're constrained by the topology of that sphere, such that omega plus omega prime is just the surface area of that sphere, a solid angle. So this implies s has to be 0 or half integer. Okay, so that's how the quantization dropped out. I'm just considering the Berry phase. Okay, so there's a couple other steps I guess you have to go through to convince yourself of this, like the equivalent of this form parameterized by phi and that form parameterized by tau. But in the end, it boils down to just the geometric, a global geometric constraint on the path integral that gives you this spin quantization. So in this case, it comes from a purely geometrical instead of an algebraic sort of reasoning. So we're just seeing it from some algebraic, you know, theory of angular momentum, spin raising, spin lowering operators, and so on. Okay, so that's what we did last time. That's, I think, one important lesson that you learn from the path integral in this class. So let me go on and write this action in a slightly different way now. Okay, so I want, so that tau derivative one minus cos theta. When I write a dot, I'm just writing the tau derivative. And let me write this in terms of the velocity of that unit vector as it moves around the two sphere in the path integral. So I have to remember what the definition of omega is. It's actually r hat if you write it. Remember when I wrote it all out? You know, it's a unit vector of the radial direction. But I was calling it omega vector. But just remember it's a part of this set of spherical polar unit vectors. So its velocity should be something like, right, the radial direction, you know, there's a constraint on the unit vector, so you can write this in terms of thetas and phis. You just have to keep these scale factors in mind. Okay, so if I compare this to the action here, I can put that omega dot in the action by defining a vector potential. And there's more than one choice for this vector potential. There's a gauge invariance associated with these things, of course. But let me choose this one here. Okay, so now my action has the velocity of the unit vector dot this A vector. It should give me back something like this. If you work it out. And just by the simple definition of this vector potential, the interpretation of the Berry phase becomes different than even what we're looking at here. So let's look at this interpretation. So now this action looks like the action of a particle moving in a vector potential. It has some charge. I guess the charge is S. So quote unquote charge. And how the vector potential affects the charge, of course, or affects the motion, is that it's a source of a magnetic field we can call B. Which is defined as curl. And if you take that curl and you do it properly in spherical polar coordinates, then you'll see that this just turns into the unit vector back again. So the magnetic, so it's like the action of a particle, you know, moving in a classical magnetic field, but the field is at the origin of the sphere, and it's of unit magnitude in this sensor, constant unit strength, pointing radially outward.
Is that a magnetic monopole then?
Right. Yeah. So it's just a monopole field, right? So, right, you can say that as a magnetic monopole. And I think, yeah, you can see that if you just wrote the divergence of B as, using Maxwell's equation, 4 pi, the charge of that monopole, right? So the monopole would have strength, you know, 4 pi with charge 1. Okay, so just another equivalent way of looking at that action. So particle moves in a radial magnetic monopole of constant strength. It's also centered at the origin of the sphere. Which is important. Because now you imagine that you have your sphere, you have your magnetic monopole with charge 4 pi, or rho is 1. Your action is describing a path somewhere around that sphere. But if you look at your vector potential, there's also a singularity in that vector potential. So by this coordinate axis, this is my z-axis here. That singularity occurs when theta is what? Pi. So when that denominator explodes. And so what you're talking about is a singularity on the minus z-axis. Does anyone know the interpretation of that singularity in the monopole language? Monopoles, you know, the way you create a monopole is you take a dipole and you break it up and you remove half of it to infinity. And the two ends of the dipole are connected by a Dirac string. So that's the Dirac string coming out the bottom there. That's like the invisible string that connects, you know, two parts of a monopole or two parts of a dipole.
Sounds like magic.
I mean, what it does is it just gives you in E and M, it gives you singularities like that in vector potentials. So it's just it's a singularity that occurs in something that's sort of gauge, that's kind of like a gauge dependent quantity. So it's not physical in what we, you know, it's not physical in the action or something like that. The, you know, if we have a very small, so I take this yellow curve and I put it such that it's just infinitesimally not touching that singularity, I can still continuously deform that yellow line through the Dirac string without affecting the action. Okay, so this only gives you, I guess, intuition if you're used to seeing this in E and M. But it's just something that occurs for us in this action interpretation. So we have a monopole at the center, you know. The particle feels the charge, the magnetic charge of that monopole. The monopole is created by taking a dipole and moving one of the charges to infinity. And that Dirac string is how you can imagine that happening. And the sort of ambiguity in defining that path defines, you know, the ambiguity in the Berry phase in the same way as the definition of the z-axis, right? So you can either pull that Dirac string down through the south pole, or you could redefine that vector potential so that the direct string goes up through the north pole, or at the top of this surface somewhere. And the only thing that'll change in the action is that global, geometric sort of definition here. So just another way of, just another formalism by which you can see the same thing. So that's omega is minus z. So you'll hear people talk about geometrical phases and monopoles and field theories in the same breath, pretty much, because this intuition of just redefining your action to have this vector potential reformulates the problem in an E&M type language, which is more comfortable for some people, I guess. Not me, maybe, but. And so in this E&M language, a lot of the phenomena of sort of modern condensed matter physics is tied to monopoles or to Barry's phases. And this derivation that we did for the single particle spin path integral is really just the simplest manifestation of the Barry phase. So there's many different phenomena that have monopole physics or topological physics that you basically see all the time in condensed matter. This one gives you, so this sort of simple Barry phase, which occurs because of the topology of the two-sphere in the path integral, pretty straightforwardly gives you the different dispersion of ferromagnetic versus anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg models, which is something that's could be derived in other ways. I guess if I had my act together, I would derive that in this class, but I'll just tell you the result. I'll just say this term effects. So it affects the dispersion of ferromagnets versus anti-ferromagnets. It causes the Haldane gap. So it's one way of seeing a Haldane gap in integer versus non-integer spins. So if you have spin change, which are spin 1/2 versus spin 1, there's a gap that occurs in the integer case, which is due to the Barry phase. So these are sort of two historical cases where the Berry phase is important. But in these cases, I would say these effects, like the different dispersion of these different interacting models and this gap, were known by other means. This one's called Haldane's gap because it was conjectured early on by Haldane. It's actually proven numerically by DMRG. It's one of the first sort of success stories of the density matrix renormalization group by Steve White, was predicting this gap, or numerically measuring this gap that was predicted by Haldane. So these topological terms become more complicated when you move away from the two-sphere, so more complicated path integrals of different topological terms. They have stupid names, like theta terms. Zimino-Witten terms. I don't know. Chern-Simons terms. Oh yeah, that's a good one. Chern-Simons terms, which are important in the fractional quantum Hall state. You know who Simons is? He's this hedge fund. He runs this big hedge fund. I think it's called Renaissance Technologies. It's like makes consistently something like a 34% like profit. Even through like 2008, he was like one of the big hedge funds that just, I don't know what they did. They short sold on a whole bunch of stuff, made tons of money. Yeah, yeah. He's one of the guys. He's like one of the original quants. He's an old guy now. Yeah, they do all this high frequency stuff. They have this like one of these pricing models that's sort of like top secret they've been using for decades. And it's just crazy. So this is the guy that runs the Simons Foundation. And they fund a lot of physics now. He's worth he's worth billions of dollars. So before he did that, he invented one of the inventors of this Chern-Simons topological term that affects the physics of the fractional quantum Hall effect. These are all different, so but they affect, you know, they give you the integer, the anomalous, quantum Hall effects. Fractional quantum Hall. This is what Bob Laughlin got the Nobel Prize for, was explaining this fractional quantum Hall. Weil semimetals, that's another one. Weil. You can have metals that, instead of having a Fermi surface, they basically occur at the node of a Dirac, like a Dirac point. And you can have a topological term that's, you know, similar to the Berry's phase. It comes out of the same type of physics. In the path integral, and it gives you a metal that has some topological property. This is what Anton Berkov works on, almost exclusively. It's pretty cool stuff. So I don't know. All of these, I guess, words I'm putting on the board, hopefully some of them are familiar to you, but I think they're worth looking at in more detail because a lot of the modern field of condensed matter is working on these types of topological terms. So the Berry phase is the simplest sort of case of a whole rich subfield of physics. And it's just a different sort of philosophy of looking at the path integral. So everything we're learning in this class is kind of like the local structure of the path integral, except the Berry phase, you know, which has something to do with the topological structure. So that's just a philosophical difference.
when you say affected by the global geometry, the integral, what do you precisely mean? Like in here, in the case of spin?
Just like this. There's a global geometry here.
Yeah, but that's the geometry of the spin group in this
case.
But what about if I, for instance, have the Isaac model on a torus or something? Could that topology also be?
That topology doesn't give you necessarily this type of Berry phase. That's not what I mean, yeah. So if I have a, if I have an Ising model on a torus, the path integral description of that thing is typically in the continuum, and the boundary conditions don't matter. I mean, they matter in some detail, but it's not the same physics that gives you this, right?
For instance, in the fractional quantum Hall effect, that's the case where if you change from a sphere to a torus, you have different physics, right?
Yeah, that's true. So in that case, it does affect it, but I think in the Ising model, it doesn't.
Yeah. Like model dependent.
I think so. I think it's dependent on the form of the path integral. So, I mean, it's almost. I guess we've seen this before. You know, when the Grossmann path integral is affected by the global topology of the partition function, that affects your physics too. So I shouldn't say it's not just local quantities. These global quantities can affect it, but this is a different type of global quantity. So. So not, I'll just say not local structure. Yeah, so you have to be a bit careful. You're right. So that's basically all I'm going to say about, specifically about this global structure of the Berry phase. I just want to do one more thing with the spin path integral, and that's derive the classical equations of motion. And we could have done this for any of the path integral derivations that we did, but I don't know, I think it's more interesting for the spin case. Okay, so we have a path integral, has a topological and a Hamiltonian term in it. And I've just been writing the action a lot, but we have a full partition function. That's the, it's the functional integral over that exponentiated action. That's the full quantum mechanics of the system. But we can find the extrem of that action to just find the classical equations of motion, right? So this, even though this is starting to look pretty bizarre, we should be able to back out the classical equations of motion from the two terms of the spin path integral action. So this is like the sanity check that I want to do now, since we've gone pretty far into la-la land here. So let's derive the classical equations of motion. So let's work with the Hamiltonian form. But you could also write some path integrals in the Lagrangian form. And the difference in the Hamiltonian Lagrangian form in the single particle path integral was somehow we were successful in performing a Gaussian integral over exactly the Berry phase, right? So it's kind of taking the Berry phase and just making it classical. So the extremal path configurations, like I said at the start of the class, give the classical equations of motion. And, since Since extremizing, is that a word? The action involves taking the first derivative. We have to take the first derivative of a functional, which is just a function of functions. Okay, so in this case, in the spin case, it's pretty nice. It just all boils down to taking partial derivatives. But philosophically, you have to remember that these are functionals and adjust your, I guess, thinkings in, to account for that. But for us, it's fairly simple, but just let me make a note of that, so.
Roger.
Yep.
One question, like in the original path integral for a single particle, mm-hmm. like that statement makes sense because the classical image is sending h bar to zero, right?
Yeah.
But in here, in the path integral for spin, we don't have that thing. Or do we? Are there factors of h bar weighting the action?
Where's our factors of h bar here? It's so in this case, the equivalent is taking s to infinity.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the equivalent of taking h bar to zero. Yeah. So I can show you after. I think if you take s to infinity, then the overlap becomes exponentially suppressed or something like that. Yeah. So that's the equivalent. But so we just need to find somehow the first derivative. So it's usually written as a variation. So my action is parameters like x and p or theta and phi. I'm always writing for these you know these spin cases. So really what you do is you just want to do some finite difference on the action where you vary the parameters such that you know, this, I don't know, they use delta, right? For these variations. And this becomes equivalent to the finite difference sort of first derivative when this goes to zero. So formally it's a finite difference. In our case, we basically just have to take derivatives of the action for all the parameters q that occur in it. So partial derivatives with respect to theta and phi. Okay, so let's write our partition function. Remember what we're doing here. Oops, got G. Okay, so the quantum mechanics involves the entire functional integral. But what we're doing to get the classical equations of motion is just taking this thing here, which is the action, and basically taking its derivative, its first derivative, with respect to the parameters. And we have two terms. And let me consider a Hamiltonian that's just the simplest S dot B. Yeah, cool. So then my action has two pieces. So S topple, I've written 100 times. But if my Hamiltonian is just the dot product of the spin in some global magnetic field. That's the simplest way to write a Hamiltonian. Then, let me see. Then this term here, I've written before, I think. Just gives me S, the magnitude of the spin, and the time integral of B dot, the unit vector. Right, which is B cos theta, if you will. Okay, so when I want to take this first derivative on the action, you can essentially just take it on, take the derivative on the Lagrangian, which occurs inside the action, if you think back to the single particle case. We can just define the Lagrangian in the same way here. There I would have something like R derivative and momentum. And the T's are the time evolution of the path. So now I have an action. It has a time evolution in imaginary time. And a Lagrangian is just these pieces without the tau integral, right? I just pull it out front. So, I'll define, let's see, Lagrangian in two parts, Doppel plus B. Which is so dumb. So this is not the Barry's phase, but it's too late now. It's the B of the Hamiltonian. Okay, and I'll do the time derivative of phi there. Let's see, plus S. B dot omega. Okay, so just two pieces. I can handle each one separately. And basically what I want to do is vary the Lagrangian, or vary the action, with respect to these two parameters, theta and phi, and set that to zero. Okay. So it's the first derivative, you set it to zero, you're finding the extrema of the action. That should give you the classical equations of motion. They have to be buried in this thing somehow. Okay, so we're basically ignoring all the quantum mechanics now. So this is like neither quantum nor many body, so I don't know why it's in this class, but I don't know. I like it. Okay, so let's start with the Hamiltonian piece first. Okay. Okay, and let me just write down what the unit vector is, so that I remember it. So it's sine phi, cos theta. Yeah, sine cos. Man, this is so wrong. Like after I've taken a derivative or something. This should be a sine. Oh, and this one should probably be assigned too. Yeah, yeah. Does that look right? I'm trying to underive it. Okay, sine, cos, sine, sine, cos. Okay, that's it. That's what we need to do. Man, if you get that wrong, you're screwed. Okay. Okay, so let's, right, so the only thing that matters really is that unit vector, because we're assuming B is constant in magnitude. So we need the partial derivative of that thing with respect to theta. This is what I was trying to undo. So this one's cos, cos, this one's cos, sine. And then it's theta, so it's minus sine. Okay, good. Okay, so maybe it's not obvious by looking at it, but if you Google it like I did, you see that it's just theta hat, just the unit vector in, that's how all these things work, right? As, you know, up to the scale factors, you take these derivatives, you get the unit vectors out. So it's actually the same thing for the phi derivative. So let's see, sine theta. I can pull a sine out front, and then it's minus sine phi cos phi 0. And so that's your like h, or your scale factor, whatever it's called, times the unit vector in the other direction. Okay, so that's enough. We can take the dot product with V with B, but let's get the topological piece first. Again, we have two partial derivatives for this topological term. So let me take the theta one first, because it's easy. So what am I calling this? L topo, maybe? Theta. Good. Okay, so the theta one's easy. So to get the phi one, let's just use multiple applications of the chain rule until it makes sense. I want in terms of that thing. So how do I do that? So I have theta dot, which is the partial derivative of theta with respect to tau. I want L topo L theta. So what I want is, oh, sorry, this is phi. So I want this in terms of theta, then I can use that expression. So then I have this theta. Okay, this will work. So then I can insert del tau, del phi. Oh yeah, okay, good. So that thing I know, just from that chalkboard, I assign theta. I have theta dot here. Oh, I forgot my phi dot. But my phi dot's divided by phi dot here. Oh man, chain rule is awesome. You just treat everything like fractions and it works. Good. So this is I S theta dot sine. Okay, there's probably an easier way to do that. Okay, so that's all we need. This will give us the variation of LB with the two parameters, and this gives us the variation of L topple with the two parameters. Okay, so what are those two equations? So one comes from the two terms varied with respect to theta. So let me collect all of this. So which one's theta? Okay, so SB dot omega. So that's one equation. And the same thing with respect to phi. I'm writing these in reverse order. I don't know why. They're additive. See, that's S phi dot B. Okay, I got sines in both of those terms, but I'm setting it equal to 0. Okay, so that's your classical equations of motion. So the trick is figuring out what the hell they mean. So let's just massage, I guess, these second terms a little bit that have these dot products in them. And for that, just remember how the unit vector looks. I want to write the time derivative. I have something like I'm varying the unit vector in, by some infinitesimal change, you know, and it's, if you take into account all the scale factors, then that time derivative in the theta direction, well, basically just like came out here, you'll just get a theta time derivative. And the time derivative in the phi direction, you have the scale factor time. Okay, again, just derivatives in a spherical polar coordinate system. So I can rewrite my set of equations. With dot products in both terms. Okay, so that's like my set of equations. Okay, so it's kind of nice if I can get something dot phi, something dot phi, something dot theta, something dot theta. And I have these unit vectors. So that one I don't need. Let me think. I think this is the right order here. So my theta, my phi can be written as minus, it's gonna be minus omega cross theta and phi cross omega. So again, this is all just, I don't know what I'm doing now, teaching a class on math phys. It's just all curvilinear coordinate systems. But I just want to substitute in for theta and for phi. Now I want to be able to pull the second term, manipulate the second term so that I have theta instead of phi here and phi instead of theta here. But I see there's a minus sign problem, so. I can see that already because I have these written in. The wrong order. I can see that because when I substitute these in, I'll get get that set. But I want to rewrite the cross product so that it's omega cross B. And I have these cross products and a dot, cross products and a dot. Should be able to use. No, B. Has to be cyclic like this. So A cross C. Well, okay. So I want to write omega cross B. But I don't know, I dropped the minus sign somewhere. I'm not chasing it now, man. That ship has sailed. So one of these will be right. They should both be right. So we can just look at the one that's right. So if I just manipulate these so that I can write omega cross B, what I should get is, I think from the first one, this will be right. You'll get minus sine omega cross B dot phi. That's what I wanted. So I got dot phi and dot phi here. Yeah, but I think the second one, because I have to flip the order of the cross product. Should have a minus sign here, but I don't know where it went. So probably one of these things is wrong. And, you know, I just worked them out like right before class. So. So see if you can track that down. Otherwise, I have these both give me, you know, this set gives me one equation of motion, which is what I was looking for. And it has to be a minus sign because what I want for the classical equation of motion is, let's see, IS. This thing, yeah, right, equals S. And the cross product here. It's like the Euler-Lagrange equation of motion. Okay, that's just a bit of spherical polar nonsense. Which is causing me some problems, but does that look familiar?
Oh, yeah,
you have two equal signs there. I don't know why I wrote zero. I had one minus the other equals zero, but I turned it into an equal sign. So yeah, so it's this minus this equals zero. So the omegas are kind of like the weird thing in there, but you can compare it to the classical equations of motion that you're maybe used to. Well, one weird thing is this omega was just used to, I don't know, define the spin. When we had the coherent state. So I can imagine and I just have a spin expectation value. So if my spin was a classical vector, you know, it's just pointing in the direction of omega. But also I did something weird a long time ago when I did a Wick rotation. Because t went to minus I tau, right? So these time derivatives are actually tau derivatives. Or that time derivative is actually a tau derivative. So this imaginary number will drop out after you Wick rotate back. Okay, so I use the, you know, I could use a different path integral that wasn't in imaginary time, but when I Wick rotate back, I'll get something that you can compare to. Classical equation of motion that's just this like Gilbert equation or whatever they call it. Okay, so it's just magnetization dynamics. Which would be the time derivative of S, which is on the left hand side. And S cross B. So you're basically equating definitions of torque. So it's sort of just the coherent state path integral analogy of this equation of motion here. Up to a minus sign, wherever that went. And it only, I don't know why it only affected one of those equations. So. Close enough for government work. So that's just, that took a while. But somehow the idea was, we just extremized the action, we threw away all the quantum mechanics, and even though the path integral looks weird, even though it's got a Berry phase and everything in it, you know, you get the right classical equations of motion. And you know, the Berry phase is, you know, it's in there, right? It's it gives you this part of the equation, so it's quite important. So again, that was all somehow non-quantum mechanical single body physics. You can do the many body sort of generalization of the single particle spin coherent state path integral. But I'm not going to do much with that unless I get time to go to nonlinear sigma models later. But I have a suspicion I won't. Let me just say a couple things about that though. So many body spins, unlike sort of bosons and fermions, are usually defined with interactions between the spins. Okay. Otherwise, you just essentially need a single particle path integral. So all the interesting physics in spin systems is really the many body spin coherent state, because you know, just like you're deriving on your assignment, it's the interactions between the spins which typically give you the Hamiltonian, not a term that's just a global magnetic field. That's like the most boring Hamiltonian. By the way, that's not true for things like integer quantum Hall effect and stuff like that. Or, you know, lots of these topological terms that I talked about before. These often arise from just sort of single particle path integrals with interesting topology derived for some reason, right? But symmetries dictated by the system. So you, when you have interactions, you have a much more complicated Hamiltonian term, which can also have Berry phases. So you have these two things which makes the many-body spin coherent state pretty difficult. So the typical example is that Heisenberg model, which you're deriving. Which I've written before. So in the many-body spin language, it's often just something like, you can have a general interaction S dot S. And in the spin path integral, well, number one, you have to know how to take the matrix element of that with the coherent states, but you know how to do that. Because S dot S just gives you omega dot omega, like I told you before. And then everything else in the path integral just moves analogously to the single particle case, or the many particle coherent state case that we looked at before. So you take your spin coherent state and you just write it as a product of single particle coherent states. So the G, I don't know what you would call it. All you have to do is sort of keep track of these products. This is many body, I don't know. Because then when you form the overlaps and so on, you just have to keep track of those products. So you'll have all these omegas. Oh yeah, and the overlap has S in it, IS, right? And this I, or sorry, this S is what shows you that the overlap vanishes exponentially when S goes to infinity. So that's the equivalent of H bar going to zero. That's classical spins. So if you have an overlap and then you basically need a resolution of the identity. Which is one. I can't remember, you're deriving one of these, but I forget which one. Or none of them, I forget. Okay, I'm getting bored, so. All of these ingredients, you basically can, you can just go ahead and write this, the path integral. So once you have the many body path integral for the spin case, the trick is solving it. Okay, so unlike what we've dealt with up till now, either many body coherent state path integrals to bosons and fermions, which are non-interacting, so they're Gaussian, so we can take all these Gaussian integrals, get the Green's function, calculate all these response functions, whatever we want to do. Or the single particle path integral, which we could basically manipulate into something that makes some physical sense. This turns it into a pretty hard problem. So there's no sense in me writing down this whole path integral for, say, the Heisenberg model, because, I mean, like, we could work through it, but it's a very difficult problem. And interactions, just like in the case of, you know, second quantized bosons and fermions, it's the interactions which make things non-Gaussian, essentially, which makes it so you can't solve these things exactly. So just by the nature of spin Hamiltonians, I think the path integral gets quite a bit more complicated to solve. So what I want to start with is just sort of a framework for, I guess, perturbative solutions for these types of interacting problems. So let me just set that up now and we'll finish it next time. So there's different ways I could do this. I mean, we could write down specific path integrals and look at the form of the perturbations and so on, but let's just build a general framework, which is more like a field theory framework. And the interactions give us terms in the action which aren't quadratic, and so that's why this is called 5-4 field theory. So what we're doing is we're abstracting more and more. We started the class with like an Ising model. It was like a transverse field Ising model, a physical Hamiltonian. We motivated the idea that we have a D plus one dimensional classical stat mech problem. Everything we've been doing are these D plus one dimensional quantum or classical stat mech problems. And with the spin path integral, all we did was show where quantum mechanics comes from, like, you know, revisit the quantum mechanics that gave us the path integral. And we've explored a bit sort of the classical equations of motion. So let's abstract further to just a sort of general field theory that's built on symmetries. Okay? So we'll go back to thinking about sort of second quantized Hamiltonians. So this is an interaction term, but let me move on from the spins and just think again about sort of raising and lowering operators and bosons and fermions. So I don't know, H. So I have a non-interacting piece. It could be like a kinetic energy, A dagger A, IJ. You can imagine this as a hopping term. It takes a particle on site J and annihilates it and hops it to site I. So it's like a kinetic energy term. And all the interactions in these second quantized Hamiltonians. All right, like this. Remember, in second quantized form, quite generally, just normal ordered, A dagger, AA, IJKL, IJ, whatever those things are. So pairwise interactions. So in the coherent state path integral, you know exactly where this Hamiltonian term occurs.
But now you're hopping like two particles.
Yeah, but it's two particles. I mean, it's like moving particles dependent on something that depends on all of them or something like that. Okay, so you can have the sort of all the interactions encoded in whatever this thing is. So you need all the indices occur basically in that thing. So okay. If you had. You can imagine having two separate hopping terms, like, you know, particles that move where the indices aren't connected, then it's non-interacting because they don't care about each other. But here they basically have to care about each other. So it's just a general way of writing, like, that's all, you know, it's a necessary symmetry of all the operators and something that connects them all together. So here it's just, in the spin language, it's like you have two indices. So this JIJ is what connects spin I and J. No matter where they are, they could be distant neighbors, it could be nearest neighbors, something like that. So. Okay, actually, let's just work on the path integral next time, since I'm always keeping you guys late. So all we're doing now is developing an approximation framework and a strategy for those types of interacting terms. And this will be a sort of a general field theoretical framework that, like, allows us to essentially construct actions based on symmetries and so on. So that's more along the sort of, I guess, maybe true philosophy of what field theory looks like, is that you'll be motivated by some term in an action or in a Hamiltonian, and you'll construct an action based on just the symmetries that you see in that Hamiltonian. And from those symmetries, from that action, you can discern most of the behavior of that Hamiltonian, or most of the important sort of behavior, just by, you know, without explicitly solving the model. And so there's some sort of coarse graining involved in the model, or there's some sort of continuum limit involved in the field theory that we'll discuss next time. But the philosophy is just that you'll get sort of universal behavior from that correspondence. So what we're going to do is we're going to take, say, all these second quantized indices, which I can imagine, say, labeling sites or labeling particles in the spin case, and taking this separation between my lattice length scales delta, you know, towards zero to get a continuum theory. So next time we're going to start throwing away all these labels. I basically want to throw away all these I and J labels and just talk about fields, which live somewhere in position and momentum space, and construct the path integral from that. Okay, so that's what we'll do next time. I'll bring you a new assignment on Thursday. And I'm like half done marking assignment one, so. Next week's reading week. You guys want to take a break?
Yes.
Yeah? You busy? You got other stuff going on besides this class? Yeah. I looked at the length of the term, and basically that's how it works out. So I think I'm supposed to take a reading week. So let's do it. Next week we'll take a break. I'll give you an assignment that's short enough that you can get it to be back in 2 weeks. But I'll see you guys on Thursday. Okay.